All right, so hello, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, hi. My name is Anna Bramberg. I am a UI UX designer. I currently live in Melbourne, but I'm in Stockholm for a couple of days. So.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Very good to have you. And thanks for doing this. And so you're the third person I interview on this podcast. And we talked a bit before, last time you were in town, but that didn't really work out then. So glad that we can make the time now.
Yeah.
And so usually I start with asking about games. Mm-hmm. What was the first game you remember playing?
I actually remember sneaking onto the family PC after everyone has gone to bed and playing Civilization until like the sun came up.
Oh, which one? The first?
I can't remember. It was like Civ 2, Civ 3?
Oh, amazing.
I don't remember which one exactly.
There's actually a podcast by a guy called Soren Johnson called The Game Maker's... What was it called? The Game Maker's Notebook or something like that.
Yeah.
And he used to work on Civ.
And
it's really interesting to hear his stories and the people he interviews, and that's really
cool.
I also really loved Civ. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. Have you played any of the recent ones?
Yes, I was playing Civ 5 on the plane across, trying to stay awake for as long as I could in order to beat the jet lag.
Cool.
So I was playing Civ 5 for most of the trip.
Awesome. So Civ and anything else? Because you... Or maybe you can also talk about where were you then as a kid?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very small little country in southern Africa called Swaziland. I was born in Malawi, but my parents kind of migrated around a bit when I was young. So my parents work with development, so we ended up in Swaziland. Since South Africa was reeling from apartheid and Mozambique was recovering from a civil war, so they ended up in this tiny little country up in the mountains.
In between
the two, yeah. So we ended up in Swaziland, which
was the best of both worlds, or the worst of both worlds, depending on how you look.
It was great. It was really great. It was really lovely. Super quiet. Really idyllic. And
was it easy to get by games there, or was it?
Not really, but because there were so many people working with development, so we had lots of people who would travel in and out. So everyone would bring something, you know. So I always got a hold of my strange niche music and
scavenging things. Games off of people's PCs.
Yeah, pretty much. So there would always be. So I had older brothers, and so they would have friends who would come over from the US or whatever, and so I'd get games off them.
Oh, cool. And so any other ones that stood out back then?
Like it was Age of Empires, there was Command & Conquer. I played The Sims as well, got that from my friends at school. It was mostly strategy games. I always enjoyed playing strategy games. Yeah.
Did you ever play the old Dune games?
I didn't, no.
No? Oh, so it's after that. Like Command & Conquer was, I guess, after the Dune games.
Yeah,
because I remember the first RTS that I really played was Dune 2, and that blew my mind. I still play Civ every now and then on my Switch. I've got Civ 6 on my Switch.
Nice.
And I do it to pass, if I need to pass time, or like you said, in the airport or on the plane or whatever.
Yeah.
Even though it's not a very great experience, I think it's better experienced on a laptop or a tablet.
Just a bigger screen.
Yeah, exactly. The Switch is kind of difficult. Yeah. But cool. And then, so Swaziland. And then, so you went to school there?
Yeah. So I went to an international school, which was pretty interesting in the sense that it was the first racially integrated school in, I don't know if it was Southern Africa or like Sub-Saharan Africa. I think it was pretty much most of Africa.
Oh, amazing.
So there was, and especially because it was apartheid times, so it was founded as an act of protest against apartheid.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you get protesters at school and stuff?
So no, so in Swaziland was racially diverse and it was very quiet and peaceful. So our school was in Swaziland, where it was very
Okay, so
chilled.
That's great.
Yeah.
Amazing, actually.
Yeah, and, like Nelson Mandela's kids and grandkids went to my school.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. That's so cool.
Yeah, it's part of the United World Colleges. So they've got these big international colleges all around the world. So.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
Yeah.
And do you remember if any friends of yours gamed as well? Or was it like a thing? Did you guys trade games or...?
I remember borrowing like Sims expansion packs from people at school. Not really. Like, gaming was mostly something that I did at home, you know, by myself. It was something that I got via my brothers.
Okay.
But, yeah, my friends at school didn't really play games. It was, yeah, I was the only one in my social circle. Maybe they did, but we just didn't speak to each other.
Oh, cool. It's so strange if you compare it to nowadays, which is the exact opposite. Like, back then, you had, like, secret gamers or whatever.
Yeah. And I guess as well, like, being a girl, like, I didn't think that any of my friends were interested in playing games because we'd always learned that boys play games.
Yeah.
So we didn't really speak about games to each other. And it's only as an adult that we kind of realize we chat to each other. And we're like, oh, you played this too? Oh, you played this too? And I'm like, oh, cool.
Common background. Like, yeah. I remember it too when I was in school, my primary school. Like, we had, it was pretty mixed, so we had half my class was girls, but I only remember one of them really playing, being a gamer back then, and it was, yeah, it was one of those things where the boys were like, oh, she plays games, she's got a Super Nintendo, whoa, you know, it was one of those things, and how times change.
Yeah, absolutely, they really do.
And so did you study then anything to do with UI or art, or what did you do next?
Yeah, so when I was 18, 19, I moved to Sweden, and as a background information, I am Swedish by nationality, so I have the privilege of accessing free education in Sweden.
Yes.
So even though I grew up in another country, I knew that when I was ready for university, I'd be able to move back to Sweden and study. So I did that, just like my brothers had done before me. So I studied design and visual communication at university here in Sweden.
And was it something you always knew that you were going to do?
No, I had no idea.
But also study in Sweden, I mean?
Yes. So that one was kind of known. As I said, like, my brothers did that before me. It was kind of, it was just assumed, you know, why would I spend a fortune studying anywhere else when I can just go back to my own country and study for free?
Yeah, that makes sense. And it was, for me, it was the same. Like, I lived in Egypt, and I always knew I was going to move back. I didn't know when I was going to move back to Holland, but for me, it happened after graduating, so I did study in Egypt. But, I did always know I was going to do it.
Yeah.
But, it's funny how that goes.
Yeah.
So you actually studied design.
Yes.
And what was that like? Did you know while you were studying it that you were going to work in games?
God, no. Absolutely not. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. And that's really, I think other people really enjoy hearing that. It's like, you don't need to have your shit figured out because... you know, none of us know what we're doing anyway. We're all just kind of winging it as we go. So I had no idea. I'd applied for a bunch of different courses, and I applied for a bunch of things that I thought were interesting, and then I ranked them in order of preference, and then the ones that I got accepted into, I took the top one and I rolled with that, and then it turns out that I was really good at it and I enjoyed it, and it was, you know, happened to be.
Wow, that's also fortunate. Like, I kind of have the same story, that I really rolled into programming. I've done it at a very young age, and so I've always kind of known what I was going to do, if you know what I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But a lot of people struggle with that. They don't know what they're going to study or how. But did you have any kind of artistic background? Do you have artists in the family?
Yeah, we have artists in the family. For me, it was more... I was always a photographer growing up. Even though I could draw, I didn't particularly enjoy it. For me, it was always work to draw. And I would have to sit and practice. And, you know, talent isn't always just talent. It's hard work. It's lots of practice. And it didn't come naturally for me to want to sit and draw every day. But for me, I could sit retouching and editing and, like, doing things on the computer all day. So I knew that I wanted to work with some kind of, like, something creative, but not straight up drawing, not painting.
Yeah.
And so we're still going to be in the digital space.
Especially with art direction. Like, I follow a lot of art directors on Twitter and on Instagram, like Ash Thorpe and Ryan Cashman, the big famous ones that work in movies. And they're all of them are photographers. And I think it's, personally, I think, I mean, I don't know why that's a common thing, but I think it's a very quick way to set a mood.
Yeah.
By taking a picture, you can look at something,
capture a moment.
Yeah, and have your own eye, like your own the way you perceive it and kind of frame the shot that way, the way you only you would see. Mm. And then in post, you can edit it to give off a certain feeling, just like directors do in movies or, yeah, or in games. And I think it's very immediate in the sense that you can just take a picture a couple of times or try to take a good one and then straight away go and edit it. And as opposed to, I don't know, painting or making a painting that conveys a mood, it's quicker, faster turnaround time. So
I think often it's a thing of like, hey, I happen to perceive like this particular little thing in a different way than other people would. And I want to show that little thing. Like, oh, I noticed this little detail. And you want to share that little detail with the world.
Yeah, it's kind of your perception of that situation.
This is my angle of looking at things.
Mm. Yeah. So you did have artists in the family and you did have that background. Yeah. Okay, that kind of makes sense then.
Yeah. So my parents encouraged me to do whatever I wanted. So, yeah, we did, even though I grew up in a pretty academic household, but it was still very accepted that if I wanted to do a creative thing, that was totally fine.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool parents.
Yep.
And then, so you came to Sweden and you studied design. Mm. And so how do I phrase this? When did you first know what you were going to do? Or like, because I guess graduating as a designer or an art director and actually starting a job or taking a job, the moment you take a job, you're actually kind of deciding what you're going to do.
Yeah, it's not, sets a trajectory.
Yeah, exactly. You set kind of a momentum.
And,
and when did you realize that you were going to make games?
So that happened, again, like everything, it feels like. I've kind of done all of my life decisions based on gut feel. Like, I don't plan things in advance. I just kind of go, hey, does this feel like a smart decision? Does this feel good? You weigh out all the positives and the negatives, and you're just like, all right, am I making a smart, informed decision? And then you go with that. So I never actually knew where I was going. I just kind of went with things as they came. So I was finishing up my degree and I realized that I was about to compete with 30 other very talented people in my class. And I knew that in about a month, it's going to be a lot harder for me to apply for jobs. So I started applying for jobs before I graduated.
You beat them to it.
Yeah.
Clever.
So I started applying for jobs before I graduated, and I landed a job working at a board game company.
Oh, cool.
So I got to straight away do some art direction and worked with print production, and that was a lot of fun. And I looked for something that I thought was going to be creative and fun, something that I was excited by.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're going to have to work somewhere for 7-8 hours a day every day. So do something that makes you want to get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, of course.
And it seemed a little bit too good to be true. And I was like, really? Board games? Can I do that as a job? Really?
And how does that go? Because I can only imagine that making a board game is, I mean, it's similar to making a video game, I guess, in the sense that you have to make art for it, you have to do game design.
Mm.
Do you, how does that work?
So the difficult thing with board games, so the thing that I struggled the most with was the fact that once it is done and you can't change anything.
Oh, no patches.
You can't push anything. Like, you can't push any bug fixes. There is no DLC.
Yeah.
There's no way of iterating on the product afterwards when it's out. Once it's shipped, it's shipped. And that was the big struggle for me, because especially when you're working at something as fluid as aesthetics and like art, because there's no right or wrong. It's not like programming where either it functions or it doesn't function.
Yeah.
So with abstract things like art, it's very difficult because your opinions on things change as you evolve.
Exactly.
And so, I'd create something, I'd be happy with it, and then a year later you see it in the shop and you're like, wow, I hate it.
Yeah, damn, did I make that?
and it was just always a struggle to see my things in shops afterwards and being like, wow, I would do that completely differently today. Like, that letter should not be over there. Or, you know, because you're so you're working so deeply on something that you don't notice details, and then afterwards you step three, you take three steps back, and you're like, wow, that should have done, and that should have been completely different.
I guess that comes with experience. Like, you, when you get more experienced, you learn how to zoom out while you're actually doing the work, which is, I guess, not, I mean, it's, you can't expect that from someone that's just started their career.
Yeah, it was my first
job. Yeah, but then it makes, like, it helps to have good guidance then and good people around you to help. But
absolutely.
I totally understand. Like, personally, I've never worked on hard print stuff like that, but I've had those moments where you ship it and you're like, oh, damn, like, or half a year later, you look at your own code and you're like, did I write this? And it's very similar in that sense, with the difference, of course, that it's changeable if it's digital. Yeah, that's fun. And those games, did you play any board games before? Or was
so many.
Yeah? Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, I played so many board games growing up. So for me, that was really, it was a very natural job for me. And because I have a puzzle-solving brain as well, and I guess, you know, people who work with UX design will often have that kind of a problem-solving brain, so... Yeah, working with board games, there's so many finicky bits and so many little things that you need to piece and puzzle together into this box. And you have to juggle, like, how are we going to do all our 500 question cards? And then, you know, how are we going to interpret a progression onto a physical piece of cardboard? Mm-hmm. How are we going to interpret, you know, how are we going to make time tangible? So lots of these kinds of problem-solving things that you sit and puzzle solve all day.
And I guess it's also an, or the difference, or I just, or this just came to me now, but if you're designing a game or if you're art directing a game, besides the TV difference, the difference of TVs, people will kind of experience it the same way.
Yeah.
But when it comes to board games, people sit at other parts of the table or they see it differently, and you have to think of that, all of that stuff too.
Where and when are they going to be playing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that you think of when you design games for mobile, for example, as opposed to console games. It's like knowing where and when people are going to be consuming your product.
And also the interruptions, because I guess, like, personally,
attention you can afford to give.
Yeah, because I've mostly worked on AAA games. I have worked on mobile apps before I started working with games.
Mm.
And you do have to think about how it's experienced, I guess, in that sense. But also, when you're making an app, you know that a person will get interrupted by either an email or someone will text them or send them a picture or whatever. And
you're constantly fighting for attention.
Yeah, and trying to get attention back as well when people are somewhere else, looking at something else.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a big difference between mobile and other types of games.
And that's a thing with, like, when you design for console games, you know that the player is going to be dedicating 3-4 hours into, you know, sitting at their PC, and you switch off the rest of the world and you put your noise cancelling headphones on and you immerse yourself completely into this experience.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you design games for like mobile and any, you know, Switch or whatever it is, you know that you're going to be playing, you know, 10 to 20 minute game sessions. Because where are people playing? It's not at home.
At
the bus stop, on a moving train, on the toilet, you know, like, where, realistically, where are people actually using this product?
Yeah.
And so you have to design fulfilling game sessions that last 10 minutes, for example, that's the time that they have.
Interesting. And it's, I guess, when I worked in mobile, we often, I worked for an ad agency, and we would often get a brief that some company, I don't know, a G-Star or a clothing brand, they had a marketing budget, and they would ask us to make an experience for mobile for them. And usually they would want it on tablet, and they would want a website as well, so they wanted this whole digital package. And what people often didn't understand when they were making those requests, that those things are different experiences. Like you said, if a person is using a banking app on a phone, that's usually a different experience than somebody who logs into his bank on a PC or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, that's interesting and a good segue. So, you worked on board games and then mobile?
Yeah, and then I slipped and tripped and fell into my next job, which was I got a job at EA. As I started off as a UI artist.
Cool.
And yeah, that was a lot of fun. I had a friend who worked there as a 3D artist, and he knew that I was looking for work. I just moved to Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I was looking for work in a new city. So he told me to apply for the job. And
that was at EA Fire Monkeys,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And wasn't that, that was two studios that merged?
Yeah.
It was...
That was Iron Monkey and Firemint.
Oh, so hence Fire Monkeys.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Yeah, and then EA bought the two and kind of smooshed them together.
And how was that? How did you... or so you joined as an artist and you...
I joined as a UI artist.
Yeah.
So I was on The Sims to begin with. So the
full circle.
Yeah,
back to the game
exactly.
that you loved.
It was so funny because when I applied for the job, even though I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, I was applying because my friend had convinced me that I was good enough for this. And I've said before when I speak at schools and things, I always say that I was convinced that I was underskilled, undertalented, underexperienced, underqualified, etc. for this job. But I'm also very stubborn, so I applied for it anyway.
it's unique as a woman because you often hear about men doing that.
Yeah.
Like they.
I mean, I would never have applied for it on my own accord.
Okay.
It was
yeah.
because he told me to.
So you did get, he did motivate you to
yes,
do it.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I would
because
never have thought I could have done it otherwise.
I was reading an article about it that men usually, if there's a list of 10 requirements
yeah,
for a job.
Yeah, it's a Hewlett-Packard study.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
So they men would apply if they've got 5 out of 10,
yeah.
and a woman needs 7 or more, kind of.
So the Hewlett-Packard study found that men will apply for jobs where they meet at least, I think it was 30% of the prerequisites. Women will not apply unless they meet 100%.
Crazy, 100.
Yeah.
It was 100. That
yeah.
was the finding. Oh,
that
wow.
if you don't check all of them off, then you're convinced that you're not good enough and you just won't even apply.
Yeah, it's like, I guess it's something basic, like men are more risk-taking, or I guess,
yeah.
or risk-averse. Women are more risk-averse. I don't know
yeah,
what it is.
I mean, this is a whole other
yeah.
like, segue that we'll happily go into. But like, it's a lot of it is also about how we condition children, about
you
how
think
we.
So? Yeah.
yeah, I mean, some of it is nature, but I think a lot of it is
yeah,
nature.
Yeah, it's always both. Right?
Yeah,
it's nature and nurture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, amazing. Well,
yeah,
it's good
sorry.
That you did it.
yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was really fun. And so I because. Yeah, to tie back into
yeah.
that, so he had told me that it was for The Sims, so I had done a complete like custom Sims style application
wow, cool.
where I like did myself as a little 3D character, and I had all my my software and skills and my knowledge and stuff.
Stats.
I had little progress
oh,
bars,
amazing.
Yeah, all the little Sim bars, and so I had myself in the intro like create a Sim screen, and so I had titled mine Hire a Sim, and
oh, cool.
yeah, so I sent that in. So yeah, it was for them. That was someone that. I mean, even though I didn't have experience of working in the digital space, I still wanted to show that I've done my research. I know what product I'm going to be working on. I have an understanding about UI. I know what kind of, you know, I know how to present shape and information and color and visual
and,
hierarchy.
And I guess sell an experience because
yeah.
that you are selling yourself to them.
Exactly. And I'm not just going to send a CV. I'm going to show that I know what it is I'm doing by presenting my skills in a way that is... applicable for the job that I'm doing and
oh, cool.
showing that I know what it is I'm
and
doing.
Was The Sims on mobile out already? Or
yeah.
Were you, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so it
was an
there.
Existing game. So
okay.
I used their visual language
oh,
and
cool.
their icons and their buttons and everything, and I used that into my application.
Amazing.
Yeah.
yeah that so it must have been so much fun to do.
It was. I pulled an all-nighter and did it overnight and emailed it in the next morning, and 20 minutes later they called me up.
Got
and
the
asked
job.
Me for the
oh,
interview.
Cool.
yeah, so that was, yeah, it was really intense. And yeah, so I started off on The Sims Freeplay and worked there for, I think I was on The Sims for about 3-4 years.
Cool.
And then, yeah, moved on to Need for Speed. No Limits after that.
Amazing. And did you grow up playing Need for Speed, or have you played any of them?
Yeah,
before?
So I played a bit, like,
yeah.
because my brothers.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did have Need for Speed at home growing up. I didn't play much, but I was like anyone else familiar
but
with.
You saw it. You
yeah.
see, sorry, you saw it in the
yeah.
household.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
I've played it as a kid.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it was kind of cool to be able to message my brothers and just be like, hey.
Working on a Need for
I
Speed
work
game.
On Need for Speed now.
cool.
yeah.
So cool. Yeah, I remember playing those growing up on PC mostly.
Mm.
I remember at first it was like a track, Road and Track, Need for Speed or something. The very first one, I had it on CD-ROM, and it was, yeah, I did play them growing up. I've not played the mobile one though. But so how, what was that like? What were you working on for that game?
So at that point, I had already migrated over a little bit more into UX design as well.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should add to that that I did do a UX design course
while
I was at EA that they paid for. I had a really, really great manager who kind of picked up on the fact that I was good at analyzing problems and breaking down structures and doing, you know, wireframing things and looking at player journeys and problem solving.
Yeah.
And she identified that I had more of an interest in looking at player behavior than in just, you know, smashing up cute icons.
Mm.
And that, not that UI art is just cute icons, let me not simplify that, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
That like I do enjoy the glossy polished shiny like cutesy stuff, you know, creating the sparkles, but I'm also more interested in like the backbones and the structure of a system and analyzing how that is built up as well.
Yeah, and it's a lot of people don't know this about EA, but at EA you do have line managers, and you can usually get courses and stuff that you want to learn about, and it's a nice environment in that sense. I've worked for a lot of companies that don't do that, so it is a nice thing.
Yeah. And like you have to be proactive, and you know, if you find something that is going to be useful, and you can show your team why this is going to benefit them.
Yeah, the return of investment, I guess.
You like invest in me, and this is going to be good.
Yeah.
It'll be good for your team.
Melbourne,
yeah.
Great. So. So how long did you work on Need for Speed then? A couple of years?
No, so that was a couple of months, I think, yeah. Didn't even make it to a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then the industry changed. And, that thing that happens in the games industry.
Yeah. The perils of working in games.
Yeah.
And so... how is Melbourne as a city? Are there
Melbourne's
studios?
Amazing.
Are there studios there or game studios?
Yeah, there's so many game studios in Melbourne. The thing is though that it's primarily indie, and
they can afford you.
That's the thing. Unfortunately, indie studios don't really have the luxury of being able to afford a dedicated senior UX designer.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah.
So I've been looking elsewhere.
We briefly talked about it before we started recording, but it is in games, or in a lot of, especially I guess with indies, because they are don't have the resources, they will probably not choose to hire a UX designer, maybe, or unless if it's a real UX heavy game or something. But I imagine that they would hire programmers and real game designers first.
And that's the thing that I've always had the privilege of working in a mobile space where people acknowledge the importance of both UI and UX design. Especially on games like The Sims, where everything is completely UI driven. So I've always been very lucky to work in an environment where my work has been prioritized and where UX designers are included in the pre-production phase. And even if there happens to be a meeting where I haven't been invited, I am able to grab a pen and paper and walk in and sit down and be like, hey, looks like I missed the invite, but I'm here now. And the team will just be like, yep, okay, cool. Have a seat.
Yeah, because I primarily work in AAA, and a lot of AAA studios, especially ones that have been around for a while, that were around before the internet, UX is kind of an afterthought, usually.
It's when they realize something's not working.
Exactly.
Like, oh, God.
Fix it in the UI.
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah, and that's a thing that happens often.
Yeah, and that's something that is really nice to see because UX is such a relatively new thing within the game space. Like, it's been around for ages within tech and in other companies, in apps and, you know, other aspects, but within games it's relatively new, but it's really nice to see that people are starting to become more and more mindful of how important it is. and that you need to be mindful of, like, your motivations and your goals and, you know, the structure and the system. Everything needs to be considered beforehand, because it's so much easier to spend a little bit of time in the beginning in the planning phase than to have to tear everything down at the end, because you need to rebuild the whole thing.
Yeah. And I read a quote that kind of struck me. I don't know who quoted it, who said it. Sorry to whoever I'm not attributing it to. It said, players will care about games from companies that care about the players, kind of, something like that. And I guess UX is, because players use the UI or the UX aspect of it, and I'm not talking about the game design side of UX, because there is an overlap. But yeah, it is part of the experience, and I think people care more about the games that care about them.
Exactly, and that's a thing that often, as game developers, we need to remember as well, that, like, we are not our target demographic. We think that, you know, we start making games that we want to play, and then we realize afterwards that, wait, people aren't playing this, why? It's like, well, you have to be mindful of your final, like, play demographic. We're not making games for ourselves, we're making games for other people to play.
Yeah.
And sometimes, if we as developers are a little bit too emotionally invested in our game, it becomes difficult to make decisions that go against what we personally would like. And so for that reason, it's really good to have a UX designer on board that's going to tell you straight up and be like, well, you know, you have to make these kinds of decisions,
yeah,
because your target, you know, the target demographic is the one that we're making this game for.
Yeah, they help you zoom out.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's something that I've seen very often. I've seen very passionate people working on games, making a game for themselves, like, and it's, I guess it's a trap people fall into, and it's not intentional. You know, people are trying to make the best possible game,
yeah,
but they are usually gamers themselves as well, and they're like, oh, but I want it to work like this because,
yeah,
muscle memory or whatever, and,
yeah,
they don't sometimes don't see it through the UX lens. Or,
yeah, and there's a really easy way to like fix those discussions or problems, or I don't really know what the expression is, but just test it. Like,
play test.
just test it. If different people, you know, if your lead designer and your UX designer have two different opinions on what you should do, that's cool. Prototype both of them, put them in the hands of
A/B
a
test.
Player,
yeah,
and go test it. Simple.
Yeah.
And that's often a very quick way to save a lot of time and meetings.
Yeah, and then there's a second trap that happens where people read, I guess, feedback differently. Or,
yeah,
they read the things they like about,
yeah,
feedback, or the things that support them. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Or, like, incorrect testing with asking leading questions.
And, yeah, that happens too.
Getting incorrect information because you didn't test properly.
Yeah, that,
yeah,
happens too.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so, you have to
so
ensure your processes are good.
Yeah, and what are you doing now? Are you freelancing or doing anything now, or you're traveling?
I'm traveling a lot.
Nice.
I am speaking to a bunch of different places.
Cool.
It's a very exciting time.
Announcement soon.
Yeah, maybe. I think, I don't know how much I can say really, but when big drastic career kind of things happen, it's very easy to get sucked into it at the time and be like, oh God, this is terrible. And then you realize very quickly afterwards that it was usually a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak to people who have been in the same situation, and literally every single one of them will be like, it was good. Like, this,
yeah,
happened to me too, and it was the best thing that happened. And I found that as well, that I'm one of these people who's incredibly, like, loyal to whatever it is I'm doing. I would have stayed there forever and, you know, possibly would have stagnated.
Yeah.
And so it's really, really, like, encouraging for me, because I've been pushed to do things that I didn't think I was good enough for. Again, it's that whole thing of not realizing your own potential.
Mm.
And then when other companies reach out and they're like, hey, we, you know, we'd love to speak to you about this and this, you go, oh wow, I could do that.
Am I good enough? Yes.
Yeah. And we all suffer from crippling imposter syndrome. And it's nice to have people reach out and be like, hey, you know, you're good at XYZ, we could use you. And you're like, oh yeah, I can can totally do that.
Yeah, and I guess it, when something like that happens, a closure, or you, I think that's the difference between, I guess, the people that survive it and the people that don't. You have to take it as a, you know, a step in your stride, and you have to learn from it and try to take the positives from it as much as you can. And
it you sucks for everyone. And you realize that it's not a personal thing, that, like, exactly, there are so many people who have been affected in these situations that, like, there is a camaraderie in that as well. Like, you all know that it's not a personal thing.
Yeah.
This is the industry, unfortunately. Yeah. Yes, unionized.
Yes, exactly. the U word.
exactly. And that, you know, we do need to change the way the industry kind of functions. But it also means that I've been able to have very high standards on the companies that I've been speaking to now. And I can set my expectations. And, yeah, you quickly weed out people or companies or places that that hesitate when you set expectations. Or other companies that will go, yeah, obviously, like, we want to treat you as a human being. Like, of course, you need to have all of these basic things that, you know, you realize different companies prioritize different things. So it's been really nice to chat to different companies and get an experience of what's out there. So
that's great.
It's been a really exciting time, actually. I've been having the best time.
Amazing. And hopefully, who knows, maybe it's a small industry, maybe we'll work together one day.
Yeah, that
would be great.
Well,
I guess, is there anything else you want to talk about, you want to say? You mentioned that you were a streamer.
So I
tuned in, or we talked briefly about it before recording, and I joined a stream of yours the other day, your birthday stream. I discovered today that it was your birthday stream. I didn't understand it, but I did have a question about it. Like, do you see a correlation between having, I guess, viewers and having users as a UX designer or UI designer?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, like, when you craft an experience, you know, you want, everyone is different in what they provide as a streamer. Some streams are about a particular game and about leveling up a particular skill set. Some streams are about knowledge and sharing. You know, if you look at people who do, like, 3D art streams, as opposed to some people who just have a pure entertainment stream where they just play, I don't know, Fortnite, just for the lols. So there's, different people have different vibes and branding, and some are educational, very chill. Some are, you know, manic and lots of effects and lots of sound and lots of all the things. So you're crafting, because a lot of the time your viewers will follow you for you. And so it's very important that you are mindful of, like, who you are. Like, you want to present something authentic, because that's what reels people in.
Okay.
And so a lot of, like, most of my viewers, I'm willing to say all of my viewers, they don't follow me for the games I play. I mean, they'll probably have trolled in because I mostly play League of Legends. but generally, the ones who stick around, they stick around because of you.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, yeah, so it doesn't really matter. Sometimes I'll do UX 101 streams. Mm. Sometimes I'll play, you know, Hollow Knight. That's what I've been playing lately.
Amazing game.
It's such a good game. I love it. Yeah. And so, like, and they don't care what you're playing because they're just there to see you. So you're crafting a vibe, and they want to... They're choosing, of all the places to be on the internet, they're choosing to be here with you.
Mm.
And that's such a privilege for me as well.
But do you at least have to cater to that a bit? Because I guess maybe, or in the sense of being consistent when you're online, or do you have to, like, how do people, like, how would a follower follow you? So you would announce that you're going to be online at a certain time, or do you consistently come online at the same time, or?
Yeah, I have a stream schedule.
Okay.
So I generally stream at set times during the week. Most people generally have a stream schedule.
Yeah.
And then some people...
That's how little I know about it.
Yeah. So for me, right now, it's like Tuesdays and Thursdays. in the evenings. I'll stream every Tuesday, every Thursday.
I'll log in. I'll check you out.
Yeah, absolutely. Come say hi.
Come say hi.
And for anyone, like, I always love having friends or even, like, people I know off the internet, whatever it is, come in, drop in and just be like, hi, I know you from XYZ place.
I use Twitch in a very selfish way. Like, I work on games. New games come out. I want to see people play them.
Yeah.
So I'd, like, go and watch people play.
Like,
yeah.
The way, like, me as a streamer is very different to me as a stream, like, stream consumer.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm exactly the same as you. Like, I've got my friends and I'll drop into my friends' streams, you know, just to say hi. But when I actually, like, want to see games being played, it is definitely, it's not just for the entertainment. That, for me, is research.
Work. Yeah. Yeah. For me, it's the same. Like, when a new game drops, a game I'm not sure that usually at companies where I work, they will have a game library and you can request them to buy it if you want to try it out, if it's relevant. But usually it's just, I want to see how people use it. And even when I worked on Horizon, when I worked on Horizon, I had this weird thing where I would frantically go and watch people play the game and tell them to adjust their save zone and their, like, screen space save zone, because our game, like, if you in your PlayStation don't set your screen save zone properly, then the HUD will scale with it. So a lot of streamers will I don't know, get a new PlayStation and not set it up properly, and I was just going around telling people that they can activate our dynamic HUD and adjust our HUD and stuff.
Like, yeah, I mean, that should be conveyed in the game.
Of course.
Yeah. And watching and streaming has made me very conscious of how I design game UI afterwards.
Okay.
And I've submitted a talk to PAX this year. We'll see if that gets accepted or not. But I would love to speak more to game developers about how to design games, like how to design not just the UI, but all kinds of game experiences with streamers in mind, considering that streaming is a growing thing. Like,
super important.
Yeah, super important. And it is only going to get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And people are consuming streams now in the same way that they watch Netflix. You know, like, it's a foreign concept to those people who don't live in this, like, in the Twitch world. But Twitch, for those who don't know, is a streaming platform. But yeah, so it's, but people who do watch streams, they're rabid about it. They love these streamers. It's people, they consider them friends. It's like listening to a podcast a lot. They become your friend after a while.
And like, now that you mentioned it, I've never ever been in a HUD design meeting where a HUD designer or a UX designer that's working on a HUD said, oh, we need to keep a space for the streamer's feed or the streamer's stuff that they want to overlay on the game. I've never thought of it that way. So,
and I did. Yeah. I wrote a tweet where I was just like, hey, streamers, you know, what is one thing that you wish game developers were mindful of when they create HUDs for whatever game you play? I got so many responses, so like hundreds of responses. And so that's basically what I used as my talk.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, like, if it doesn't get selected at this PAX, like, I'll do it at some point.
Do it on your stream.
Absolutely, that's a great idea. But it was really interesting because, you know, all these streamers, like, oh, I never have anywhere to put my camera. I never have anywhere to, like, put my chat. You know, all
it's like
of
this a
stuff.
Streamer
flashes.
Mode, which gives you like a corner of the screen where you can actually put stuff.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, so, I mean, some games will have streamer mode enabled for things like audio.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that Dream Daddy, for example, has streamer mode where it just removes the copyrighted music so that your stream doesn't get silenced.
That's
super
amazing.
Your VODs will get silenced during those sections.
Oh, of course.
And as a streamer, that sucks because I'm speaking during those periods.
I never thought of that.
It's not just the music, because it's all one audio input, so your voice gets cut out as well.
So if a game licenses a piece of music to be played in their game, and then you stream that game, you don't have the license to stream it.
Nope.
Oh,
yeah.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, and so it'll have an entire portion of like 7-8 minutes where you just can't
silent.
Hear. It's just a completely silent stream, and you see the streamer is speaking because their mouth is moving, and you have no idea what they're saying for 7-8 minutes or however long it is.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah. So, like, stream, like, clearly games, game developers are starting to think about streamers a little bit in some terms. So, for example, with licensing. But yeah, in terms of UI and kind of the general UX experience, it's not really been considered.
Seems like there's a lot to win there.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Cool. I'm going to take
especially
this on
because
board.
Like when Apex first came out, what you know, it was became the number one viewed thing on Twitch instantly. Everyone got on because not everyone had access to like being able to play, but everyone wants to know what it's about.
Yeah.
So everyone was watching people stream it.
And it's now that I think of it, it's Apex. Their whole marketing campaign was around streaming. Like they didn't even announce a game until it was released,
yeah.
And their marketing budget was spent on streaming. So
yeah.
You would expect them to have.
Yeah.
Some streaming settings or something, but
so it's a thing that like clearly the industry is mindful of streaming a little bit now, and like a lot of companies will speak to streamers in terms of promoting their games, and you know you'll get players doing like I know I've got friends in Australia that have been playing Borderlands 3 on their stream
before
it's launched.
Cool.
Yeah, so like they clearly companies are beginning to think about streamers as marketing and all that kind of thing. So that's really good, but yeah. In terms of our industry, we still need to be mindful of how we work with streamers and make their lives easier.
Because I remember also on Horizon Zero Dawn, we had like a preview event for streamers. So we flew them over and they had like these setups where they could play the game and stream it on their, they could log in and stream it on their channels live.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is starting. That's a good thing, I guess.
Yeah.
I will come see your stream. I'll check it out.
Awesome. You would be so welcome.
I'll be a convert.
Come hang.
Yeah. And so where can people find you?
So my stream is called The Hangry Games. I've always kind of adopted my online handle within games has always been something to do with being always hangry. So when it came to naming my stream, that seemed like a natural name. So yeah, so twitch.tv/thehangrygames.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Twitter, you can find me at Anna Bramberg.
Okay.
And then, I mean, Instagram is more personal than industry stuff. But yeah, same there.
Well,
yeah.
Thanks a lot for doing it, doing
Thank
this
you.
Podcast. And hopefully people will, it will help people, I don't know, find their way into games or
Absolutely.
Find their passion.
Yeah, and if you have questions or anything, and like I'm always really excited to hear from women and from girls, and like even if you're in high school, you're trying to figure out what you're going to do, like yeah, reach out, chat to me.
Reach out to Anna, she'll help you,
yeah.
and me as well, reach out to me, I will try to reply to as much people as I can.
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, bye.